Our recent visit to Detroit has tempered my skepticism. You should reconsider your decision.
What am I supposed to do? Fly a shuttle into the system and knock on the door? Tell the Zindi we want to talk? The weapon is too close to being launched. If the situation were different, maybe I'd consider it, but I can't.
I don't want you to die. It's not necessary.
I wish that were true.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, discovering he's genetically modified.
And we're here this week to talk about how characters evolve. But before we get to that, Tyler, I think we need to talk about how the franchise has evolved and how it's going to evolve in the fairly near future, because we had a lot of Star Trek news this past week.
I think this is the busiest week of Star Trek news we've seen in a long, long time. Where to start? I don't know. Cam, have you been brushing up on your French language skills since you stopped doing it in elementary school?
Oh, I barely did it in elementary school or high school. That was a very sad journey that we are best leaving to the side.
It's always embarrassing when I travel overseas and people think I'm bilingual because I'm from Canada, and that's really not the case. But Cam, Star Trek Prodigy Season 2 has premiered in France.
and ended.
Yeah, they dumped all 20 episodes on like the French streaming service, and it's all like dubbed in French. I have not touched any of the spoilers. I'm not looking at any of that, but I what's our takeaway other than like maybe this incentivizes Netflix to get going with putting Star Trek Prodigy's next season on the air sooner? But I mean, in my head, like, does it make sense for them to do that while Discovery is running, and that could potentially take away some of the marketing steam that's being put towards Discovery? I don't know. Like, it's interesting, but like in my head, I think maybe Prodigy was more likely to premiere on Netflix maybe in September or October after, say, Lower Decks would presumably wrap its usual summertime / early fall run.
Yeah, like I'm sure that Netflix had a strategy as to when they wanted it to come out, and they were going to have their marketing built around that time period, and this kind of throws a wrench into the works. So I would expect that there were conversations behind the scenes about, like, what do we do about this? Maybe we should push it up, but they're not going to immediately just announce in the press it's coming out next week. They may be, like, quietly bumping it up, though.
Yeah. Look, I'm still pumped for it. I'm also pumped for it to get like a Netflix platform. I just hope that really brings so much more attention to Star Trek Prodigy, which is so like sadly overlooked. Like, just you and I were guessing that maybe only tens of thousands of people have ever seen the show, which is kind of a bummer. But yeah, hopefully we'll get it on Netflix sooner rather than later. Cameron, other news. So Section 31 has wrapped filming in Tirana.
Hallelujah.
Yeah. I get the sense that this is going to be a show that probably premieres by end of year. You know, that we have a still image of, you know, one Giorgio, speaking secrets into the ear of a man with like a robot mohawk.
Sold me. Sign me up.
So there is like a slight spoiler. Cover your ears, audience members. This is a light spoiler, but probably a very intriguing one. So cover your ears for the next 60 seconds, I suppose. But fair warning. So it appears one of the main characters in this will be a young Rachel Garrett, who goes on to become captain of the USS Enterprise C. So that tells me that the timeline, I don't know, like would have to be, what, like 50 years after Star Trek Discovery premiered? Like when Prime Giorgio was captain of Discovery, that was like the 2250s. But if it's a young Rachel Garrett, that tells me it's like the year 2300 or so. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, how old would Rachel Garrett be in yesterday's Enterprise? Like,
she was probably late 45, I'd guess.
Yeah. I was going to say mid to late 40s. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess we're going backwards maybe like 20 years before that.
Yeah. So I just, who knows what timeline shenanigans, you know, Giorgio fell into in her Terra Firma Sayonara two-parter episode back in season 3. Or maybe it's just a big time travel deal. Maybe that's what she's up to with Section 31, is traveling through different time periods or something. I don't know. Cam, does any of this excite you for Section 31?
No. Section 31, I think the thing that excites me the most is that it's a movie and not a TV show I have to track week to week. So yeah. That's exciting. The Rachel Garrett thing, it just screams of like fan wankery.
Yeah.
That I'm like, okay. I mean, look, maybe this character shows up and is an absolute blast, and I go, oh, I could see like genuine potential for doing more with that character in the future. That's always the hope, but on paper, that's not something that excites me, because, like, I don't know, they announced, you know, or they didn't announce, but they had like the Gary Seven supervisors show up on Picard. In theory, that's something that would be interesting on paper to me, but in practice, like, whatever.
Well, the other thing is, oh, okay, I think with the Rachel Garrett thing, you're just going to have someone say the name, like, I'm Rachel Garrett. And if you don't know who that is, it doesn't really matter. If you know who that is, you can say that's cool. But with the Picard supervisors, like, do you remember the clunky exposition they made Patrick Stewart deliver to explain the whole Gary Seven and the supervisors dealio? Like, I don't want anything like that going on in the Section 31 film.
No, I mean, that was atrocious, and I felt embarrassed for Patrick Stewart having to recite that dialogue, because you know he had no idea what he was talking about.
What are you talking about? Come on, Cameron. He was a huge Trekkie back in the day, watching Assignment Earth nonstop on a loop. That's why that was included in season 2. He is an executive producer, after all.
Of course, yes. That's my guess as well. Like, this Rachel Garrett character will be someone who... Yes, it is that character, but it's not like it's set after yesterday's Enterprise or anything like that. Like, it's a basically clean slate with this character. They can just do whatever they want, and it's more just like the kind of the, not in-joke, but like the kind of the fan kind of fiction nugget that fans can go, oh, cool, I know that character.
I am excited by the actress, Casey Roll, or Roar, I forget her exact name, but she was featured in seasons, I think all 3 seasons of Hannibal, the Mads Mikkelsen, Hugh Dancy show, and she was really good in that, and so I'm excited to see what she brings to the table there. That news is coming from this very large Variety cover story that, well, it covered pretty much everything going on in the Star Trek universe right now, including that Star Trek 4 has yet another writer at the helm. One Steve Yawkey is now working on a draft for Star Trek 4, Cam. Does this mean anything to you? Like, I would love for them to, if they can wrap up the Zoe Saldana and company sort of adventures, sure. I think this is a cast where you don't necessarily have to, like, put a bow on it, like, maybe keep the door open, but it's been almost a decade since their last adventure on the big screen. This is just pretty ridiculous at this point.
It will be 10 years before this movie, like a 10-year gap between movies, if this movie comes out. Like, that's embarrassing for a franchise. Like, I would be fascinated to see who shows up to see this movie in theaters. I don't know I'd be investing that much resources into it at this point in time, but I mean, I admire their gumption to continue to try. I hope they crack it, because honestly, of all the Star Trek movies that they've, you know, flirted around and announced and what have you, this is probably the one that still excites me the most, just because I really like that crew. I like the world that they inhabit, like kind of the vibe of that series. And I would like a more satisfying finale to where they've been going than Beyond, which was fun, but pretty inconsequential.
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I, we ultimately gave it like a, I think we ranked it, we both ranked it number 5 out of all 13 Star Trek films, which I think it's more of an indictment about like the varying quality of the entire film franchise versus a big pat on the back for Beyond, which we thought was nice. We both liked it, you know.
It put the B in Beyond.
I know, it put the B in Barco. That was
Oh, God.
Has anything come out in Barco Vision since then? Or have you seen anything in Barco Vision in the theater since then, Cam?
Okay, the answer is no, I have not seen anything. But Barco, they've changed the name to something else, and I don't remember what it is. But they play movies constantly in that mode in our local theaters.
Do they?
And I have they do. And I have avoided it like the plague. I think Ghostbusters, the new one, Frozen Empire is actually playing. Yeah. Yeah, it's playing in that mode. In that, what is
really?
It? I can't remember what it's called. I think it's called like Escape or something like that. I think there's an X in it.
Okay, well, just for those that might not recall, Barco is where you've got like the screen in front of you in the theater, and then on each side of that screen, there are other screens projecting additional images, or like widening the screen at times as well. It's pretty hokey, pretty gimmicky, not worth the extra bucks.
No, it's basically like screensavers around you a lot of the time. It's pretty shoddy stuff. Okay, so I just looked it up. It's called Screen X now, and we can currently go and see Godzilla X Kong, or as I've seen some people call it, Godzilla Kiss Kong, the new Empire.
Okay. The trailers look pretty bad, and the reviews are pretty bad. I don't know how soon it is before I go see that.
How is it we have back-to-back blockbusters, Frozen Empire and New Empire?
You know what? It's the, do you remember when they had the Edgar Wright and then Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg films back-to-back that one summer where it was This is the End and The End of the World?
Yeah, and there was also actually in 2009, going back to Star Trek 2009, and then Terminator Salvation, it was The Future Ends and The Future Begins were the two taglines they had.
Okay. Oh, sorry. I got it mixed up. It was called, the Edgar Wright movie was The World's End. And then the original title of the Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg movie was The End of the World. Mm. But Edgar Wright reached out and asked them to change it. And so they changed it to This is the End. So
right,
they're trying to avoid some marketing mishaps there. So there you go. Listeners, we're giving you gold here.
They said that, was it Godzilla Kong made $75 million and Ghostbusters did $45 million. So clearly people were more excited for a new empire than a frozen empire.
Okay. So with that movie news there, you and I talked about it, you know, a couple of weeks ago. But, I mean, there's another Star Trek film in the works. You know, it's being directed by Toby Haynes and scripted by Seth Graham Smith. That this is also from the Variety story, which says that film is further along than the Star Trek IV movie.
Shocking.
Yeah, from the sound of it, I mean, all we know is that it takes place like decades before like the Kirk and Company films do. Which my guess is the most obvious thing means like Earth Romulan War sort of deal, you know, like, because the way that they describe it in the Variety story is the movie will quote unquote serve as an origin story of the sorts for the main timeline of the entire franchise. So that tells me it's after Archer, but before Kirk. And what's the most obvious jumping off point? It would be Earth Romulan War, but I don't know if I want to. War movie necessarily to define kind of a Star Trek film for audiences. So hopefully I'm just a super uncreative person, and much more creative people than me are working on something a little bit more intriguing than that.
Well, it's like they're going to want to give a general audience, and I'm not talking Star Trek fans, because they want to lure more than just Star Trek fans to these movies, something that's going to be exciting and something they need to see on the big screen. I have a hard time seeing this about anything to do with, like, I don't know, the relationship between the Vulcans and the humans. A more insightful look than maybe Enterprise gave us. And, like, what else is left in terms of, like, the origin of the timeline? Is it going to be World War III? Like, are we going to see the nuclear wars on Earth? I think it's going to be something big with a lot of, like, effects stuff. And I think Romulan War is probably, it doesn't excite me, but it's probably the one that I would prefer to see versus the World War III movie.
Yeah, I want a standalone adventure where they're a small ship out in outer space, way off, and there's some sort of philosophical stuff that they have to figure out, but there's enough adventure going on to draw in new audiences. That's my best case scenario there.
I think it's really tough, though. Like, it's a tough assignment to come up with a Star Trek movie that's going to kind of play in the big leagues in theaters, because like Star Trek movies, some of them have done like really well, like Into Darkness, for example, but like they still don't compare to like the big blockbusters out there. And I know that they want it to be bigger than it is. Yeah. And I just don't know if there's an easy answer to that. And I don't know that like a origin of the Star Trek timeline is going to be the draw that they necessarily want.
I think they lucked out. I don't want to say lucked out. I think they were very fortunate to land that Kelvin vs. crew and cast, mm-hmm. and get kind of a fun story going in 2009 to draw in big audiences. And I don't know how many times we can keep saying it, but they utterly squandered all of that. And mm-hmm. so I don't know. I just don't know. I don't think in this era lightning can strike twice. And I think the best thing for them to do is bring back that cast, pay them their big bucks, and then any other Star Trek film, I mean, I'm just being realistic. Like, I think they're going to work better on like a streaming service or something like that versus like try to put $200 million into a movie and try to drive people out to theaters. It just seems like a different era. And also, I think a lot of studios are rethinking why are we putting $250 million into this film? Like, I think they can... Mm-hmm. I think a lot of these studios are going to be thinking, like, why don't we just put $100 million into a film? And I'm sure, you know, we can find more creative ways to, I don't know. Like, a lot of this is just, like, really bad VFX done at the last minute. Mm-hmm. Why not do more practical things? Or, I don't know. It just seems like the current sort of, like, blockbuster era is just kind of not working anymore. Just look at the state of the Marvel Universe at this point, I would say.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be very tough with Star Trek also, just because there's so much on streaming right now that what's the motivation for the general audience to run out and see this movie opening weekend? And that's what they want, those opening weekend numbers. Like, it is a incredibly tough assignment, and also to market a Star Trek movie to a general audience without Kirk, Spock, Picard, like the big names.
No, get Paul Wesley. Come on. the easiest thing would seem to be is get that Tarantino script. It just from a marketing hook to a lower budget, that just seems to, is it just a really bad script, Cam? Or like, why are they not interested in something that seems like such an easy marketing hook?
It must have been lousy, right? Like the script that was ultimately written by the writer of The Revenant. Like, Tarantino and the writer of The Revenant, they don't strike me as like the same kind of tones, but I just wonder if they were like, the Tarantino pitch was incredibly exciting in the room. They got the script from the writer of The Revenant and they were like, huh, this excitement really didn't carry over to what I'm reading right now.
I don't think it's that. I think, like, they got the script. I bet it was just bonkers. It was just utterly bonkers. And they're like, what are we going to do with this? That's my guess. Like, if you're a professional writer, I think you can genre hop just as effectively as we've seen the professional writers in the Star Trek series genre hop week to week. Mm-hmm. And from what we heard about that script, it is what's that gangster episode from the original series? But essentially, a piece of the action cinematic reimagining of some sorts. I'm sure there's going to be twists and turns we could not have known about at this point. But I don't know. I think it was just like a wacko bonkers script, and that's why we're not getting it.
Do you think these Star Trek movies will happen?
What's the state of Paramount right now, Cam, in which we've got like some sort of attempted fire sale going on with regards to all their assets, and that the studio itself would be hived off from the streaming service, which that to me, I don't know if that is great for future Star Trek projects, especially in the cinema kind of mode right now.
Yeah, and if it is a big investment, they might start to rethink that. Like, I feel like Paramount may want to take safer bets at this point. They may want to just get that Top Gun 3 going instead.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would be intrigued by, look, I'm more intrigued by a Top Gun 3 than I am by a future Star Trek film. I just think Star Trek belongs on television. It's just, that's where the stories really come to life for me.
I will sign off on the Kelvinverse crew. If they can make that happen, that is at least exciting to me because I like that cast.
Yes.
And I would just be happy to get a resolution to that journey. Like, if it's not great, well, whatever. You know, Dial of Destiny wasn't great either. Like, that wasn't the journey's end I wanted. But I would still rather have... Like, the thing about Beyond that's frustrating is, decent movie, fun to watch. It in no way feels like closure to the run of that crew.
Yeah.
It feels like a middle chapter.
I know. They need to come back with that crew, and they need to be in the Wrath of Khan era uniforms by that point.
Yeah, and maybe, like, we could just say that Chekhov's on the Reliant at that point, and we can, like, have, like, different character dynamics and, like, make it feel like kind of like a grand farewell to this crew, and maybe, like, steer away from just, like, the evil madman who wants to, like, destroy things or take over the galaxy. Yeah. Like, do something a little different.
I don't even want to say goodbye to this crew. I you know what, like, Kirk and company, they had, what, like, a good solid 12 years of, now that I think about it, Kirk and company had 12 years and they got like 6 movies out of the deal. It's been what, 15 years since Star Trek 2009 premiered, and we've gotten 3 movies out of it.
It's a little bit like the Daniel Craig run as Bond versus Roger Moore, where Roger Moore had less time but cranked out like 7 movies and Daniel Craig did 5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Cam, some other news. I guess in Strange New Worlds, season 3, we'll get a bit of a different science lab.
Sure.
Okay. I mean, that to me, that's not like a huge big deal. But like, I guess Jonathan Frakes did an interview, and he's going to direct another episode in the 3rd season, and he describes it as a Hollywood murder mystery, which what's a murder mystery versus a Hollywood murder mystery, Cam?
That's it. Excellent question. Knives Out is a Hollywood murder mystery, I suppose.
But Death on the Nile is not?
It's based on a book, so maybe not.
Okay.
That's a question for Jonathan Frakes at the convention this summer.
I'm sure he'll spill.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Are there any news that I'm forgetting or that you wanted to bring up?
There was, actually. The Starfleet Academy TV show
Is
ready to roll, and they have, I think, their largest set ever for this show or something along those lines. And I was like, well...
What the hell?
Right? I was like, oh my God. Like, you and I had just assumed this had evaporated into the air. We were wrong. Dead wrong. This show is going.
They want to start filming this summer. And I'm like, okay, Godspeed. I'm not interested in a 32nd century Starfleet Academy sort of dealio. You know, I think there is potential for a Starfleet Academy series, but when they're saying stuff like it's going to be the largest set ever built, covering like both an atrium, you know, like lecture halls, classrooms, and I'm just like, I think they're going in the opposite direction of what I want. I want small stories. With these cadets. I don't want these giant... Well, Cam, is every single cadet episode going to be about the end of the universe? Like, that's what my worry is, you know.
Yes, it will.
But that's just it. When we see, like, how, like, Picard and Discovery has to frame every single episode as, like, well, of course there's a mystery box element, but it's all about saving the universe. I'm just like, these are cadets. These are supposed to be small stories, you know? Like, I want that, and... This doesn't scream small to me. This, and I don't know.
When they, to promote this show, are just saying, we have the biggest set ever, I'm like, it reminded me a little bit of producer Dino De Laurentiis when he was making the 1970s King Kong, and that movie's not good. And the way he was promoting it was, wait till you see the size of the monkey.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, okay, sure. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I guess we'll see it. I don't know. I'm still not sure we'll see it just because of the state of Paramount, though. Like,
yeah.
Are you pumping all this money into a show when you're trying to sell off your company?
Yeah. And I mean, we haven't heard anything about casting for this show at all. Like, what is going on? Like, it's so weird to me how this show has been radio silence, except for this announcement that they built a giant set.
Well, Cam, you do recall that we do know that Tawny Newsom, who plays Beckett Mariner on Lower Decks, she is on the writing staff of Starfleet Academy. And she told us at the last convention she's happy to answer any questions that she can about the Academy show when she was doing her panel. And remind me again, Cam, how many questions did she answer?
Okay, it was zero, but let's also just emphasize, this was a Star Trek convention where almost no one could talk about Star Trek because they were actors, right? And like, you know, the actors weren't going to talk about the shows that they were on because of the strike situation at the time.
Well, no, about 33% of the actors weren't going to do that.
Well, in theory, no one's talking about Star Trek at a Star Trek con for like 4 days. It was, you know, a lot of questions about favorite colors, things like that, hobbies, do you like cats, that sort of thing.
Do you shop at Target?
Yeah, exactly. Here is a Star Trek star on stage saying, I am writing a Star Trek show and I will answer questions about the property you love if you ask me those questions at a otherwise Star Trek-free Star Trek con. And a room full of Star Trek fans still did not care enough to ask a question about the Star Trek show that's, you know, going to happen.
Yeah.
It's insane. That is an insane way to kind of frame it.
I just think it shows like how much demand there is for an Academy show, which is none. And I understand why they're pursuing this. They want to get younger folks into the Star Trek universe. I get it. I just don't know if, like, I think the much smarter strategy is something like Prodigy. And, but that's much more of a, you know, like, hoping these kids, you know, grow up in like 10, 15 years, they get really into the other more adult shows versus, hey, let's get some teenagers off their TikTok app and start doing like Starfleet Academy TikTok dances or something like that. Like, I don't know. It's just kind of like, I don't think this gamble is going to pay off personally.
No, and also like Lower Decks, I think would speak to a teenage audience probably just as well. And you could actually do little snippets of it and drop them all over TikTok, but that clearly hasn't really connected in a huge way. Okay, look, if Paramount puts out the Starfleet Academy with, I'm going to assume, because I have no other way to go right now than Tilly is the spinoff character who's teaching at Starfleet Academy. If this show explodes and takes the youth of the world by storm, I will like bow down to Paramount to be like, you guys were geniuses. I never saw this coming.
And when 35-year-old Sylvia Tilly is the teen sensation across the globe.
She's the next Wednesday.
Yeah. Okay. Cam, you and I need to work on our TikTok dances. That's all I can say.
clearly.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get into how characters evolve, Cam. And specifically, I don't think we mean to talk about their stories. You know, I think we want to talk about their arcs here. And just to kind of illustrate, I think the difference, though, is like, let's pull Ben Sisko out as an example. You know, his story is a Starfleet officer who just wants to get off the station and raise his son on Earth, to a man who embraces his emissary status as he fights through this galaxy-changing war. That is his story. But his arc is really, how does he change as a man in terms of his temperament? I would say that he becomes a lot more comfortable in his own skin. You know, if you look at how he would deal with one situation in season one differently versus, you know, season seven, maybe a little gruffer, maybe plays a little bit more fast and loose in terms of morality as well. You know, that's kind of an example of like arcs here. And I think, maybe the way we jump into, Starfleet, or I should say Star Trek Discovery, is kind of talking about kind of the arcs of those characters. The show is premiering in a few days. And so I think this is kind of be a fun exercise right now.
Yeah, yeah, but let's remind everyone also, like, where the characters are as we start that season, because it's been a kind of an insane journey.
Okay, well, look, where Burnham started, though, is she's kind of a very stoic, Vulcan-like sort of Starfleet officer who goes on to embrace much more of her human side as the show goes on. But honestly, Cam, like, her arc is she turns into an entirely different character by the time we get into the second season. And this is kind of where Burnham, always being guided by her emotions and kind of bringing on that messiah complex, really comes into the forefront. So where we leave her off at the end of season four is like, I think she's mostly defined by the relationship between her and Book and the tensions that those two are having throughout season four. And ultimately, it's kind of unclear where their relationship stands going into the fifth season.
Yeah, there's a constant kind of like push and pull of Burnham's dedication to duty and then kind of the dynamics of her personal life, because obviously you had the stuff with Ash Tyler and then you have it with Book as well. And it kind of like piles on the torment for the character. So it's always this kind of emotional battle for her to deal with whatever the world-ending crisis is of the season. But we've gone through this journey like three times now. And I'm really interested to see if they can find a way to make it feel different, because generally with like an arc, you want to feel like there's an actual evolution. Go to the title of this week's episode. Like, we want to see the character evolve, but I kind of feel like Burnham, has she really evolved, or do they find kind of like a placeholder for her and kind of repeat it three times? I guess we could say that like there's been more of like a sense of comfort as a leader, you know, being the captain of Discovery, but I feel like they're kind of often repeating the same kind of journey.
Well, it's always, she's a total rebel. And if Starfleet authorities would just listen to her from the start, everything would be fine. But she has to go against Starfleet every single time. And guess what? She's always proven correct, which I don't think is very interesting, you know? And it's also very pretentious. So, my guess, Cam, is, you know, we're going to get into the fifth final season. There's going to be some sort of like galactic event that, you know, the Starfleet authorities don't really trust her about. And she's going to have to go her own way and prove everyone wrong.
You and I have not watched season one Discovery since like the first time we went through it. And then when we rewatched it for the Blu-ray review, I wonder how insane it would feel now to go back to that season and watch that character.
Well, not just that character. Why don't I bring up Tilly at this moment?
Sure.
Because if you think about when she's introduced in episode 3 of Star Trek Discovery, she's like this totally like neurotic motor mouth. Mm-hmm. She has chilled out quite a bit to the point where like people trust her to be in command of situations. Although she did get Discovery captured at the end of season 3, you know, which was acknowledged in season 4. But it was just interesting because a lot of folks in fandom were latching on to, say, her as well as Saru as kind of these analogous representations for maybe neurodivergence, be it maybe social anxiety, or this is maybe some projection. I don't know if it's meant to be one-to-one, but maybe some people see some sort of like autism spectrum traits on some of those characters in those early goings. But I don't, you think all of those traits have essentially been dulled over the last four seasons?
Well, I mean, with Saru, 100%. Like, you know, the Saru kind of like anxiety issues really were gone after Vrahi. It was like, okay, he's cured. And I'm like, I don't know that that's the most inspiring journey for like an audience, if there is kind of that kind of like a metaphor going on with that character. Okay, sure. And Tilly, yeah, it's like people legitimately love that character. They found her funny. They wanted to hang out with her. They wanted to be her friend when they watched the first season or two of Star Trek Discovery. At this point, I mean, season 4, she just vanished almost entirely. And I have a sense of like a character who's, the most interesting thing is someone who early on is like, I want to be a captain. I want to be a captain. Who maybe starts to rethink their journey and maybe finds a different inspiration in life and a journey they want to go on, perhaps as a teacher at Starfleet Academy, I don't know. But it doesn't feel like it's been kind of like a flowing kind of journey. It feels like it's a very choppy one.
Yeah. So where do we leave off with her at the end of the season? She's more about embracing command situations versus where I think her comfort level was in the first season of Discovery. So I can follow her arc. I just don't know if it's made her a more interesting or compelling character over the years. And I don't, again, I'm not all that intrigued by a Sylvia Tilly-centric Starfleet Academy spinoff where she's giving pep talks to, like, teenagers, like, every episode.
No, I'm not particularly either. And getting back to Saru, like, I feel like they've made the character kind of, like, more soulful, almost like to make him something closer to, like, a Spock figure as we've gone down the road. He always seems, like, much, like, wiser now, whereas earlier on there was a little more tension with that character. And, I mean, I guess it's, like, Doug Jones is so great in the role that I will just watch him anyway, but it does feel like they've kind of, with all these characters, really, like, it's almost like hitting fast forward on an arc after season one.
Well, okay, like, you brought the Vorahai thing, you know, because, like, prior to that, in, you know, one third of the way through season two, he really was defined by his timidity. And I just don't think you can have a convincing captain if he's defined by that. That's, like, his most obvious trait there. And so for a couple episodes, he starts embracing aggression, you know, like, he wants Culber and Ash Tyler to fight in the mess hall. Sure.
Gentlemen, you know. Gentlemen, let's see how this plays out.
but then after that, he just seems like as you say, like, maybe a wiser old soul, you know? Mm-hmm. And I guess he was defined a lot in the last season by, you know, seeking out, like more of a romantic relationship with the Navarre president. So, you know, what do you expect to see from him going into the fifth season based on where we left off with him in the fourth season?
I think where we're going to see this character go is really just a lot more emphasis on the romantic relationship. Like, they're going to be in a different place now than they were at the end of season four. And I really think, like, when this is all said and done, this is kind of like the say farewell to Saru, because he has a happy life. He's found, because early on, like, the kind of the journey of that character was that he was very isolated and he didn't have anyone to connect to. And by the end, he'll probably have a family or something like that, and we'll leave him in a happy place.
Yeah, he'll have Sukal.
Exactly. You know, this show loves to adopt adults, and he will adopt an adult.
Yeah. Speaking of somebody who's adopted an adult, Paul Stamets. Again, his first five episodes I thought were amazing. This is the first real asshole main character from Star Trek. He was hilarious. He was a total, like, jerk, but he was, like, he was making sense even when he was being a jerk. Then things got groovy once he combined the mycelial network DNA into his own system in a magic to make the sanest man go mad. And he softened quite a lot. He's a bit curmudgeon-y now, but a lot of his arc has just kind of been defined by his relationship with his husband, Hugh Culber, and then their relationship with their adopted child, who is 45 years old, Adira. And I don't know, like he's got some curmudgeonly traits, you know, especially when he's talking to Reno, but it's an arc that is just bizarre because a character essentially reinvents itself about halfway through the first season.
Yeah, I mean, he's had moments where he has, like, anger towards people, like whether it's Book or whether it's Ash Tyler, but beyond that, and I think a bit against Burnham as well at one point in season four, maybe, I don't even remember, but, like, he feels like a character who, I remember when we were watching, I think it was season two, and we were really like, oh, like, he really felt like Stamets was on the back burner that season, so hopefully we get to see him have a more complete story in season three. And then we didn't. And then we said, okay, well, hopefully season four we do, and we didn't. So I honestly, at this point, would be shocked if season four, or season five, I should say, paid a lot more attention to him. I don't even know if I feel like this character's gone on that much of a journey. He almost feels like he's kind of been forgotten on his own show.
It's very strange, just because Anthony Rapp is clearly, like, a very charismatic, like, performer. And it just seems like a lot of lost opportunity with that Stamets character based on where he started. But it doesn't sound as if, like, the creatives liked how that character behaved in those first five episodes. I don't think, like, doesn't seem as if, like, the Discovery crew is all about, like, hugs and kisses and loving each other all the time. And so his character just seemed kind of like an antithesis to what the creatives wanted to do. with this crew moving forward. And among those creatives, I include like Sonequa Martin-Green, who I think you can tell she had a lot to say about her character's arc starting in the second season as well.
Yeah, it feels like they began to really embrace Culber a lot more because he brings like more of a warmth and positivity to the show. And you saw a lot of that with several counseling scenes with Adira and a few other characters through seasons 3 and 4. And it's suddenly like, oh, like Culber is the one being given a lot more of these scenes, whereas Stamets is suddenly taking a little more of the background or just playing comedy relief with Jet Reno.
The only other character that I want to bring up, there's like a bunch of, believe me, Cam, we do not have time to go through 80 main characters across every single Star Trek series, but within Discovery, I do want to bring up Georgiou. You know, when we met her, and I'm talking about Mir Georgiou here, is, you know, she went from kind of like murderous tyrant to reluctant ally to anti-hero. I don't know what to make of the character other than when Michelle Yeoh started playing her very deliberately arch. Her charisma was too hypnotic for me not to like, and I really had problems with that character in the first season. But from season 2 onwards, I've really enjoyed the character, even though, problematic, genocidal, murderous, sociopathic. You know, how is her character going to be different going into the Section 31 film based on where we left her off in that Terra Firma two-parter that it seemed as if she had embraced what it means to be more of a prime universe sort of human by then?
Well, the thing about Georgiou is, like, in terms of the logic of that character's arc, it makes almost no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
But when you plug a movie star into that role and give her, like, all of the best lines on the show, suddenly it's like, you know what? This may be messy, but I'm having a blast every time this character's on screen. So maybe I should be, like, a little more positive about the Section 31 movie, because if you're going to give me, like, a Star Trek streaming film, at least I have Michelle Yeoh probably just tossing off quips for 90 minutes, and it'd be like, okay, you know what? I'm having fun, at least, with that. And this character, her evolution is interesting. The way she went from, yeah, as you said, like, a complete, like, you know, evil individual, just a completely sadistic monster, to someone who has almost like a tough mother instinct towards Burnham and is apparently going to be a Section 31 operative. I'm like, okay, like, I'm curious to see how she handles, like, responsibility of being a key member of an organization, because we saw a bit of that, obviously, with her with Section 31 previously on Discovery, but it still felt weird. I'm hoping they can make a little more sense of it this time.
Yeah, what if James Bond was given like the job of why am I blanking on M?
M?
Yeah. Like, what if James Bond was given M's job? Like, it'd be kind of like chalk and cheese there. Like I just don't know if it'd work.
Yeah. And so if she's going to be the one, like, leading a team, my concern is it dilutes the character because they need to then write her as a responsible leader. But hopefully they go a little more James Gunn Suicide Squad with it.
I was literally going to say that. We'll see. Let's jump to some of the other Star Trek shows. I don't know. So how does Captain Kirk deal with situations differently in season 1 versus season 3, Cam? Like, this is a different era of television. I just wonder if, like, kind of the better examples would to point to, like, Kirk from, you know, early on to where we leave off with him in, like, 1991 or 1994 with the film franchise, you know? Like, how is he different? Like, how would he deal with situations differently? I go back to maybe kind of Search for Spock. I wonder if that is one of the key points for him. And he's willing to, you know, take over the Enterprise in dry dock, and then he has to deal with the death of his son. And I know I'm going into more story versus arc, but I think that might be one of the most defining moments in his arc and how he deals with situations from there on forward. Because, I don't know, we think about how he dealt with... Could you imagine season 1 Kirk, as we know him in season 1, dealing with what was going on in Star Trek, the Undiscovered Country? I think he would handle things very, very differently in Undiscovered Country if it was season 1 Kirk.
No, I think, like, Kirk's arc, you know, you look at him in TOS, the first 3 seasons, it's very much like someone who has a swagger and almost like an invincibility about him, and is a young character. And we see the way that just the experience of life changes him over that. You know, the way he makes decisions, the way he deals with situations. He isn't this kind of like physical specimen that he was when he was training Charlie X in the gym in season one.
Sure.
And it's about that character constantly, not just like grappling with mortality, but accepting it and letting it change the way that he does his job and the way he holds himself as a man. So it's in a way like kind of like the most obvious arc, because he is kind of our first Star Trek captain that would go through that journey, because ultimately it's about the human journey with Kirk, but they have to get a little more outside of the box with other characters. But I think like this one holds together really well. It's just that when you look at TOS, the TV show, there's not a lot there. It's more about the movie era.
Well, and that's why I guess the only other one I think we should talk about is Spock, because there's pre-Kolinar Spock and post-Kolinar Spock. And I grew up with the post-Kolinar Spock as a kid watching the movies before I got into the show. And he is a very different character. He really has had, I think, the much more sweeping arc among the original crew there. And like, he's much looser when he's younger. It kind of is almost the opposite, which we see with the other characters we're going to be talking about, in which the other characters seem to be a little bit more comfortable in their own skin as they get older. But with Spock, it's him getting tighter and tighter with how he approaches things from, you know, season one of the original series through to the end in Star Trek Into Darkness, when he's making warnings across subspace channels.
Yeah, the thing about Spock is that, like, I like the way that you see him, as you said, like, looser when he's younger, and then getting very reserved and almost icy over the course of the motion picture, and then kind of, like, reawakening. And what's really cool about Spock is then you jump to 2009, and it's like we finally see a Spock who found the balance. It's like his whole life journey was finding a balance between kind of the rigid sort of sensibilities of the Vulcan mind versus like the human warmth, because there is genuine warmth coming off of him in 2009.
I like the way you're going with that. So why don't we jump over to Star Trek The Next Generation? I think we have to tackle Picard. But I think, should we include Star Trek Picard the series? I think we have to, though, because like I don't think there's really any character in Star Trek Picard the series worth tackling other than Jean-Luc himself.
No, I agree. Yeah,
I don't know what to make of this, Cam.
This one's insane, and we have to just take it as one character's journey, because while we can make the point he's a robot after, you know, season one.
Sure.
Like, you could just say that. You could be like, dismiss him and be like, look, he's a robot. It's not the same person. Ultimately, the show is telling us it is the same individual going through this entire journey. So let's look at it from that point of view.
Okay. So he starts off as kind of a cold, aloof figure who finally goes and plays poker with his crew after seven seasons. And, you know, but it's also... I don't know if it's Picard softening up so much as him being willing to let his guard down in certain situations as the show moves forward. And I think we see that throughout the course of Next Gen. You know, we get action hero Picard in the movies because that's what Patrick Stewart wanted. Mm-hmm. And then I guess in the spinoff, Patrick Stewart wanted a doddering old fool to play with, who is just completely feckless, and there really was no arc other than his continued fecklessness across all three seasons.
Yeah, it's like Picard early on, it's like someone who doesn't necessarily see the value of connections and makes more and more connections over the course of the series into the movies as well. Like, he feels like a member of the family when you get to those movies. Yes, he's an action hero, but like when he's hanging out with the other TNG crew members, like it feels like these are people that all love each other. It doesn't feel like he's the kind of stone-faced guy he was in season one TNG. With Picard, he's much more... It feels like he's much more driven by emotion than he was earlier on in the run of the show. He was very intellectual, especially on the first seven seasons, or the seven seasons of TNG. Whereas, like, Picard, a lot of his decision-making seems driven by, like, various emotions, whether it's anger, whether it's, like... you know, wounded pride or something. Like, he's always like driven hubris. By something like that. Hubris, yeah. Sheer effing hubris, yeah. It's always like that sort of thing. And he becomes like a very grandiose old man. He almost feels like he should be like standing on street corners yelling at people a lot of the time. But okay, let's jump to like the final season of Picard. Like, do they find a landing point for that character's journey? I guess someone who, maybe a family man?
I don't know. He's getting yelled at by Frakes. He's getting yelled at by Riker.
Yeah.
Get off my bridge. You've doomed us all. And it just, he still seems like a doddering old fool in those moments, you know? And like, where, like, does he have like real leadership moments? Like, you're talking about like, okay, like he has kind of the fatherly story. But I don't know if I can reconcile that like with like any real true leadership other than like, he sits on the bridge of the Enterprise D, which looks awesome to all of us as fans. And but it just, it's kind of fan service, though. So I'm just like, his arc is just like, just so disjointed and nonsensical to me as I watch three seasons of that spinoff show.
It's also hard for me to buy into the Picard specific father arc. When you have him with Elnor in season one being like, hey, Elnor, remember me? Well, see you later, Elnor.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he's abandoning people that could be like spiritual children to him. And so then you just cut to season three where it's like, I'm embracing fatherhood. Well, it's like, I've watched this character fail at this multiple times and often just seem very cold.
It seemed disingenuous, I guess, is the best way I would sum up this character's arc. I completely followed the arc from seasons 1 through 7 of TNG, and then to a lesser degree, Action Hero Picard in the films. But then it just all falls apart for me. It's not the same character, though. It is Patrick Stewart playing an entirely different character.
It's also, over the course of Picard, a man resolving all these traumas he carries. But none of that was present in his earlier parts of the journey. So you can't even kind of track that.
Well, the whole mom storyline was, I think it was just like a terrible storyline.
Oh, it was. Yeah. And, you know, like I like the way that they resolve things like the best of both worlds events of, you know, the Locutus story in TNG and then even in First Contact. But I didn't feel like, even though they kept bringing it up throughout Picard, that they were doing anything particularly, like, you know, ground-shaking there with that character's journey.
No. Again, it just seemed like more fan service than anything else. Okay, Cam, I guess Data would be the most logical one to tackle. You know, we get him in TNG season one. he's played like a six-year-old to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. You do see that character's arc and him learning... episode like we brought it up last week, but an episode like Data's Day and him just kind of like being able to better glide through human situations. But then I think about the Offspring as well, and it's almost kind of a sad story in more ways than one because he literally had no emotions over the death of his daughter. It was the audience projecting our own emotions for like a phenomenal episode onto him. And what made it even sadder for us is we saw that there were no emotions going on in him. So I guess like I'm ultimately wondering about like how much the emotion chip plays a factor into his ultimate arc across kind of the movie eras and moving into what we saw in Star Trek Picard as well.
I feel like there's a little bit of a hiccup there because the emotion chip should lead, I think, organically into where we go with Picard. But it felt like they just pulled back on that with Nemesis because they didn't know what to do anymore, and so Data just became, you know, kind of a more like standard Data. But other than that, I do think like there is something about just the Pinocchio narrative of this character who wants to be human, experiences all these various facets of being human, but finally gets there in Picard season three where he's actually going to continue to live a life as what he wants to be. So I actually think like Data's story, minus the kind of Nemesis hiccup, it's pretty good. It actually holds together much better than Picard's.
It feels like the same character, despite the fact that he has the emotion chip, that he comes back from the dead a couple times, you know? it holds together much better than when Jean-Luc's does.
Yeah, yeah. Should we maybe talk about Riker? Because I think Riker's is kind of interesting in that he's someone who, when we see him on the show, he's very much like this embodiment of like kind of youthful swagger. He's a young guy training under Picard, and the way we see him like grow as like a husband, a father, and then like a more seasoned captain and admiral, as you said, like shouting down Picard,
barking at
in
him.
An episode of Picard, barking at him in season three, Picard. That's not the Riker we saw in season one. And I think the thing about like Riker is his arc isn't flashy, and it's easy, I think, for people to overlook in comparison to, say, Data, but it's very much there.
On that note, I agree, but I think we also have to bring up Troy, who also seemed to be playing an entirely different character in the first season versus where we found her by the seventh season and going into Star Trek Picard as well. She didn't get the flashiest of episodes. In fact, she didn't get a whole ton of Troy-centric episodes, and she probably only got one Troy-centric episode that was actually like really, really good. Mm-hmm. But she did have an arc. I think a much more pronounced arc than maybe somebody like Beverly got, or that Geordi got, or that even Wesley got there. And I enjoy her arc. Like she's even like realizing she wants to be a full commander as well. Like I enjoy mm-hmm. her arc in a way that it kind of surprises me, just because she didn't get as much screen time that I think a lot of the other main characters were afforded throughout the run of TNG and the films and Star Trek Picard.
What's interesting, too, about her deciding she wants to, you know, take that command test is that, like, she gets, like, kind of the process, or we get to see the process on screen of her making the decision and guide her way through it. Whereas, like, I would have liked that element of the Beverly story, but they just have her assume that role so that we can see another character decide to do that. Whereas I would have liked to have actually seen Beverly actually moment to moment kind of make that decision in her own life.
Yeah. I guess we kind of got that when we got to the Descent two-parter. She had kind of the shaky skeleton crew there.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. Why don't we jump over to Deep Space Nine? We can talk about Worf here as well. I mean, I brought up Benjamin's arc right at the top, but unless there's anything you want to add, do you want to jump over to the Worf arc of it all?
Yeah, I mean, we talked a lot about Worf, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes where we did the Evolution of Worf episode. But yeah, like Worf is one who's a very like pronounced arc. It's actually quite good.
He starts off as like defined by nothing, like in the first mm-hmm. season. He's defined by just like being super aggressive, and he's defined by his makeup, essentially. Then they actually find a job for him after Tasha Yar departs. I think that's very critical towards his arc. And it all these seem to have made sense for if he had just been security chief from the get-go. But we get more and more about how he is defined by honor throughout his arc. And we get the Klingon politics stories that's, again, not to focus so much on his story arc versus the character arc, but that does feed into what drives him, what motivates him. And it's just kind of this dishonor that hovers over him like very, very dark rain clouds there. But he is fairly one-dimensional in the next gen. And you jump over to Deep Space Nine, he's given like much deeper relationships with, say, romantic partners. They try to rehabilitate his relationship with Alexander, even though we only got a couple episodes of that. You know, like he, and it comes back to, I guess, like that sense of wanting to belong in Klingon society. I think that is probably the most defining part of his character arc, is that sense of being an outcast all throughout. And then by the time we end it, you know, he's in the same house as the Chancellor of the Klingon Empire.
Well, I mean, we've talked about him on this podcast about being kind of like a Ronin and like masterless, and like so much of the show is Worf cut off from, you know, the Klingon society and often humbled throughout the run of TNG and DS9, where he can be very arrogant, he can be very prideful. And the way we see him kind of find that balance, kind of like Spock does, you know, find that balance in his case with like this honor code and being almost like a more vulnerable character. And there's not a lot of that early on in TNG with Worf, but the way you see him by the end, you know, season three Picard, I like where Worf has gone. I would have liked more there, but I like kind of the gentler Worf, even when he is like beheading people, I guess.
Sure. He's grown up, I guess you could say.
Sure. Yeah.
And he beheads people too.
A lot.
Yeah. Quite a bit. Kira. A lot of people hated the character when she first debuted on the show. I wonder how much of that is kind of like a little bit misogyny. But it's interesting, like by the time we get to the end of the series, she is really like a fan favorite. But I don't know how much of that plays in the fact that she does soften up quite a bit as the show goes on. She was always portrayed as quite religious from season one onward, but I think she embraces it more and more as the show goes on as part of her arc as well. But I don't know. She's just, it's a very fascinating arc in what she sees somebody who essentially had to serve as a child soldier. And she has essentially what she sees as the next group of occupiers on her planet. And she definitely softens and she's able to trust more. Not just a group like another organization, but just the people that she's around that aren't part of the Shikar resistance cell, you know? So it's just a very fascinating character that we have here.
Well, she's driven by like anger through so much of the early stages of the show. And, you know, you think about like her resentment towards the Cardassians. By the end, she's like cradling Damar as he dies. Yeah. We see that she has like a father figure who is a Cardassian. And, you know, you cut to her at the end, standing next to Jake, looking out that window. That is not the Kira we saw when she first showed up on the shows. It's someone who's, like, found a sense of peace and belonging on that station. And I'm happy she's still there when we, you know, visit her in Lower Decks. Because it just feels like it's a Kira who is at peace after being at war for a long, long time.
Yeah. And I think probably the most pronounced arc of all, the character that changed the most from the first episode to the last episode, people are probably screaming out his name right now, Cam. Miles O'Brien.
Yeah, yeah. Big time. Big time.
Yeah, yeah. Look, he's a static character, but like for me, he's the most intriguing of all the characters that just seem to be like pretty like straight on the narrow. Static isn't quite fair, but you can just tell that like he's there to do his job. And it makes sense. But obviously, I think we're talking about his best friend, where we find Julian Bashir, green behind the ears, definitely uncomfortable in his own skin. But we start to get like the hints of like serious Bashir, I think starting in season two, especially like an episode like The Wire, where he's doing everything he can to show himself to be like a responsible doctor trying to save his patient. But I think the turning point for the character is when he can finally reveal that, you know, he is genetically modified in Dr. Bashir, I presume. And that's where I think he is like, okay, I can just kind of be who I am moving forward. And it's just, it is, I think, the most intriguing character arc among all the shows, just because how much he changes from the first episode to the last one. And it seems completely organic, unlike a lot of the stuff that we were complaining about in Star Trek Discovery.
There's a little bit of almost like a Kirk journey, where it's just like the weight of lived experience with Bashir. Because, yeah, when you first see him, he's like a puppy dog. He is just like brimming with energy and excitement for this new frontier he's going to be, you know, adventuring on. And by the end, he seems wizened. He seems tired sometimes. He seems like someone who has lived a life and is going to carry that experience forward and probably play more of a leadership role as an individual, versus where he definitely does not feel like that very much of a leader in seasons one and two. And it is very much that kind of like the shaving off the edges of youth over the course of his journey.
But it's also kind of like that's what happens to anybody around that age, where he goes from like his essentially like mid to late 20s into like his early to mid 30s.
I mean, I'm still the same way as I was in my 20s.
Well, no, teens. Your teens.
Teens, yeah. What up, kids?
For listeners, he really, like, the Steve Buscemi meme is actually based on Cam.
That's true.
I just briefly mention Jadzia Dax, who kind of starts off pretty stiff sort of science character into, I think, probably just the loosest character in terms of, like, how comfortable she is in her own skin. Mm-hmm. And she ends up marrying her complete opposite.
Yeah, no, very true. And I think they maybe struggled with what to do with Jadzia early on and then just realized make her the life of the party and the fans want to come along with that character. And it makes like her loss that much sadder because she is often kind of this like very strong emotional character that can really be moving on screen, but then also is like the character that like connects like, say, Quark to a lot of the other crew members because he is so fond of her and has so much fun with her. I think it's a really interesting character arc because it's not just the wise old man. It's also the character who's the most reckless and fun sometimes.
Yeah. Let's jump over to Star Trek Voyager. Captain Janeway. she's like, let's embrace this journey that we're on for, you know, early on. And then she goes to, like, I'm here to kick ass and chew bubble gum, and I'm all out of bubble gum by the time we get to the end of it all.
Yeah. I mean, that really is it. It's kind of like this Katharine Hepburn protective mother figure in the first season of Voyager. And by the end, she's throwing on phaser rifles. She is saving the ship. And we really get to see kind of the extent she will go to get that crew home.
Yeah, but I think one of the most defining parts of her character arc is that mentorship side of her that she took up with Seven of Nine. And speaking of Seven of Nine, that's a character who joined the crew trying to get the crew assimilated and leaves off. It's kind of a sad journey in Voyager because, like, she's kind of left without a family other than Icheb, who we know is vivisected in the Star Trek Picard universe. And that turns her into a serial killer by the time we get into Star Trek Picard.
You forgot her very promising romance with Chakotay, Tyler. I mean, that went places, right?
I tried to scrub that from my memory, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it is kind of like fascinating to have this character who wants to assimilate the crew, and by the end of Picard season 3 is the captain of a Starfleet vessel. That's yeah, kind of amusing. Yeah. I mean, it's a sad journey for Seven at times, but, like, there is something kind of poetic about that. Like, someone who is stripped of all humanity, being a member of the Borg, becoming like the like a leader in the most human organization out there.
Yeah. I guess the Doctor is worth mentioning here. That is also a very pronounced arc in which he goes from kind of this sort of like hived off, lonesome character who really only has Kes that will treat him like an actual person, into kind of this real fun, loving character that is really embracing humanity or what it means to kind of have a soul to a certain degree when it comes from everything from photography to opera. And then he turns into one of the most annoying characters on Star Trek Voyager. I just, by the time I think we get to maybe season 6, 7, he just turns really, really grating. And it's episodes like Virtuoso in which he abandons the crew to perform opera in perpetuity on an alien planet, where I kind of turned on the character by then.
I kind of like the idea of him leaving Starfleet, which I don't know if that'll be the case when we meet up with him. I think he's going to be appearing in Prodigy season 2. But, like, to me, it made more sense in that alternate future we saw in the finale of Voyager Endgame, where it's like, oh, he's off doing other things. Like, this is someone who's found independence and has interests he wants to pursue. That, to me, is kind of the Doctor's journey, not like, well, I'm still a doctor. I'm still doing that stuff with Starfleet.
I think that totally makes sense, but only after you get the crew home and you don't abandon them without a doctor on board a ship on a very dangerous journey back to the
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. I'm talking about the future of the character, of not course. That point in time. Yeah, yeah.
I just briefly bring up Tom Paris, who I think was kind of meant to be like the number two on the call sheet when Voyager premiered. Mm-hmm. He was kind of supposed to be the bad boy, the one with the redemption arc, and he just kind of turned into a softie as the series went on. I like Tom, but it's very clear that, like, I think the intended arc for him changed. Well, I don't know if it changed. I think ultimately it was meant to be kind of a redemption arc, but I think it changed much quicker than maybe what was originally anticipated. I think he was going to have, like, a much harder outer shell for a much longer time.
Well, it's kind of like both him and B'Elanna. He had two characters who were at war with each other, or, like, with their inner selves, I should say. Yeah. Who ultimately found, like, peace and a union between the two of them. So they kind of, like, combined both of their arcs into kind of a very similar thing, even though there was obviously specifics of Klingon versus, you know, Tom's past and what have you.
Yeah. Want to jump over to Enterprise and talk about one Jonathan Archer?
Oh, I thought you'd want to start with Reed. Okay.
Okay. Pineapple cake. Pineapple cake, Cam.
That's right.
Look, he starts talking about gazelles in the first episode, and he starts giving hugs to T'Pol by the last episode. You know, like, it's interesting, like, how Archer's arc is, like, I think it comes to the most prominence when we get him to seasons 3 and 4, in which he is pushed to his limit. And, like, it's almost kind of a Sisko arc, where you see that Sisko starts playing fast and loose with morality while he's in the like battling everything from, you know, Maquis fighters to Jem'Hadar soldiers, Archer's pushed to this limit, it's existential for him and kind of the fate of humanity and the planet Earth. And so it's interesting because he kind of seemed like just kind of a pushover those first mm-hmm. two seasons where he'd got his butt handed to him in hostage situations every other week.
Well, it feels like Archer is tasked with basically writing the book on how to be a Star Trek captain or a Starfleet captain.
Yeah.
And we see him do that over the course of the show through trial and error and, you know, great, you know, I mean, look at the Zindi War, like great tests of what he has to go through to be a captain. And by the end, it really does feel like he's ready to just ascend beyond that. You know, like when he's starting the, you know, the beginning of the Federation and what have you, like it feels like, okay, he had that experience as a captain. He's ready to move on to bigger things. It doesn't feel like Archer's journey really ends. It feels like it just gets bigger and bigger.
It kills me that we didn't get that fifth season because it feels as if there's so much more for him to explore as a character. You know, with Trip, though, this is an interesting one. And like, he kind of starts off just in the good old boys club with Archer. Let's be a jerk to T'Pol. And again, he's pushed to his limits in season three, dealing with the death of with the murder of his sister at the hands of the Zindi at the end of season two, and how he can't really come to grips with that. And I guess, look, a naked Vulcan performing neuro pressure sessions on you, I guess that'll loosen anyone up. Okay, Trip, I'll take your word for it there. But he is kind of like a fan favorite pretty consistently throughout the run of the series, though.
He has a little bit of the Bashir arc of kind of that youthful idealism
that
is definitely shaken up by circumstances, you could say, more traumatic than what Bashir went through, like the loss of his sister and the anger he carries through season three. And this one is always going to be frustrating because, like, we find a more confident, at ease Trip and having a relationship with T'Pol, wanting to become a father and have a child with her. And then that's all undercut by him dying in a really stupid way.
Only in the holodeck.
But his arc is basically youthful idealism to the grave.
Yeah. I will say this. I think one of the most important parts of his arc came in season four when he transferred over to the Columbia as the chief engineer there. You know, like he couldn't be around T'Pol anymore. It was too like painful for him. But I think it was too painful for Archer to deal with Commander Kelby as the chief engineer. So Kelby was one of the most defining parts of Trip's arc.
I mean, he's one of the defining parts of Star Trek Enterprise for me. So, I mean, makes sense.
T'Pol, Cameron, this is not a character I liked very much in the early goings of Enterprise. But I think that's the fault of the writers in which... like they made her a wet blanket early on, you know, like they really had her condescend down to the humans. She became my favorite character by the time we got to the end of the series. Like she really does have this arc in which she is willing to embrace humanity in a way that she was not when the show started. She literally resigns her commission from the Vulcan Expeditionary Group, you know, to take on a new role with Starfleet going into season three. To help him with the Zindi. She embraces relationships, close, very, very close relationships with, say, Archer and Trip as well. One of the most intriguing things or frustrating things in those early goings of Enterprise is like, you know, why are the Vulcans like so much angrier in this era of Star Trek than I've ever seen them? Well, they got around to explaining that when we get into the season four Vulcan mythology arc as well. I'm like, okay, so I understand why T'Pol is a little bit testier than, say, once Spock was as well. Like, I think she has the best arc overall on Enterprise.
I know that most fans will point to her relationship with Trip as kind of the relationship that means the most to them when it comes to T'Pol. But to me, like, it really is the Archer connection she has. And I think of, like, early season, you know, one and two, where, like, there's moments where T'Pol's in trouble or something happens and Archer like stands at her side. And like, you see the way that Julian Blaylock plays those scenes where it's like almost like a Vulcan who doesn't understand why this individual is standing up for her. And the way that you have that kind of like very unflashy establishing of trust over the course of those seasons, to the point where you mentioned, you know, that Vulcan arc in season four, where they're traveling together through like the Vulcan deserts. And yeah. It's like they are so at ease with one another. And I think like there is such a warmth, and you know, that finale is terrible. We've talked about it. It's a trash fire. But that moment where they're hugging at the end, like that is not the T'Pol we were sitting with in season one. And to see that character's journey, it feels so organic. And it's probably the best, I think, pulled off arc in Enterprise.
Cam, that journey that she and Archer took through the deserts, it really reminded me of when you and I were journeying from Las Vegas to Los Angeles on a road trip, and we could not find a bathroom stop anywhere. And it was very torturous for us, just as it was torturous for T'Pol and Archer.
Yeah, I never realized I could hold something in that long. It was, it felt like hours.
Listeners, we never did find a bathroom.
I'm suffering so much right now.
Yeah. Look, we already kind of tackled Discovery and Picard. Strange New Worlds and Lower Decks and Prodigy, they're still going on. I don't think we're in a place to really comment on those characters until those shows wrap up. But overall, I what series do you think had the most, I guess, like arcs, satisfying, I guess is the word that I'm looking for. Like, what series had the most satisfying arcs overall for you?
There's individual cases. Like, the T'Pol one is very satisfying in Enterprise. Yeah. But I think overall as a collective, it's DS9. Yeah. Like, that show, I mean, because we didn't even talk about, like, Galdakod and Garak and all these other characters who also go to different places. That show just specializes in character arcs. Whereas, you know, you look at TNG, you look at TOS, they're relying on the movies as well. Whereas DS9, as a 7-season entity, just took those characters on an incredible journey.
Well, I would say that we've got some interesting stuff to look forward to with the premiere of Discovery next week. You and I, we're going to take a bit of a different tact in terms of how we review the episodes. We will be moving forward. We haven't decided yet if we'll do week to week or maybe just check in every few weeks on the show. But I think you and I were talking off air and we were like, okay, well, maybe there's a bit of a different way in which we could talk about this series, in which I think it'd be more enjoyable for us, so that we're not just bashing the show nonstop. And it'd also be more enjoyable for listeners who don't want to just like tune in because it's a show that they like and just hear us like bash the show. I'm hoping the show is an entirely different kind of animal that I can embrace, but my suspicion is it'll be kind of how it was from seasons 3 onward.
Yeah, that's the hope. I would love to get back to the anticipation I had in seasons 1 and 2 Discovery, where I was looking forward to the next episode versus like seasons 3 and 4, where I was, I was waiting for that next episode, but not necessarily with any sort of anticipation.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, we'll be back next week with the season 5 premiere of Star Trek Discovery.
That's right. And of course, leave reviews for us wherever you get your podcasts. They are very much appreciated with rankings. And you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in viral Tilly TikTok videos, Smith.
And you can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTON. N as in Nog's TikTok videos from You Are Cordially Invited. That dance there, pretty badass.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
And 135-year-old Sylvia Tilly is the teen sensation across the globe.
She's the next Wednesday.
Yeah. Okay.